In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock and Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow, subscribe, rate, and review. I spoke recently with Colin Blundstone, lead singer in The Zombies. That was to cap off our Zombies Week here in the Underground Garage. We were celebrating their documentary Hung Up on a Dream and the upcoming reissue of their seminal 1968 album Odyssey and Oracle, coming out in mono on vinyl. We'll hear a portion of the album's hit, Time of the Season, followed by my chat with Colin on your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock here in Little Stephen's Underground Garage.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands
to take you in this time to
promised lands,
to show you everyone.
What's your name? Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy?
He rich.
Is he rich like me? Has he taken
any time
to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
Mighty Manfred with you in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and we've got a very, very special Coolest Conversations for you today. I am honored to be speaking with Colin Blundstone, best known for being the lead singer in The Zombies. And with our chat, we're capping off our Zombies Week here in the Underground Garage, which we've been celebrating with the upcoming vinyl mono reissue of the band's seminal Odyssey and Oracle album. Also, we've been celebrating their documentary Hung Up on a Dream, which is screening now all across the country. How are you, Colin?
I'm really well, Manfred. It's great to talk to you.
Oh, yes, man. I have to say, so enjoyed seeing the movie several weeks ago when it screened, did a screening in Los Angeles, and I really wanted to talk with you more about it then, but, you know, I felt like you had other fans there, and we get a chance to speak later on, and here we are.
Brilliant, isn't it? It's great, isn't it? I'm so sorry we didn't get more chance to talk at that screening in Los Angeles, but it was a little bit crazy. And but here we are. We've got an opportunity to talk now.
Exactly. So first, let's do some chatting about the movie since the screening is going on. Today's Friday, July the 11th, and is showing this month in Somerville, Massachusetts. That's in the Boston area. Falls Church, Virginia is in the D.C. area. Washington, D.C. area is also showing in Chicago, Detroit, San Francisco. Another screening going on in Los Angeles and in Jersey City, New Jersey. So thinking about the documentary, how often have you been approached over the years by people wanting to make documentaries?
Well, that's interesting. We have been approached quite a few times. In fact, someone had started a documentary on us just before this documentary was put together. So that at one point there were probably two documentaries going at the same time. But this is the one that won through. So there has been a lot of interest in the Zombies' career, and I think it's possibly because it's not a typical career. The Zombies sort of came and went. You know, we started off with a number one hit record, She's Not There, and then gradually the tracks faded away, and then we came back with Time of the Season, then we disappeared again and re-emerged as what I always call the second incarnation of the band. At around 1999, there was a huge gap where, although various members of the band were still working together, Rod and myself were working on various solo projects, but there was no Zombies news until 1999. And then it all started to happen all over again. It's kind of an interesting story. And although that second incarnation of the band never really had a big hit record, we did really develop the band. We started off in small back rooms of pubs, and then basically by word of mouth, we ended up playing at really big venues, the Greek Theatre, Albert Hall over here, the Palladium over here, and Glastonbury, all the big at the Isle of Wight Festival. We played most of the big venues, and it was brilliant. I really enjoyed this second installment of our career. It was really exciting. I had a bit more time to enjoy it this time. It was a bit of a whirlwind the first time around.
All right. Well, so Hung Up on a Dream, the documentary directed by Robert Schwartzman, do you recall, when did he first get in touch with the Zombies about making this documentary?
Probably 2 or 3 years ago. It's a little bit hazy about who spoke to who. I think actually he spoke to our management company first. Mm-hmm. And then we had a Zoom, exactly the same as we're doing now, between Rod Argent, myself, and Robert. And firstly, he really understands the film industry and how you make a film. You know, he's directed other movies, scripted and fully financed Hollywood movies. But also he's a musician as well. He has a band called Rooney, who have had chart records, and they actually opened for ELO on their farewell tour in America. So he understands musicians and the music business. And it was apparent right from the beginning that he had this musical background. And also he was a real enthusiast about the Zombies. He genuinely is an enthusiast about the Zombies. And we were just thrilled to be working with him.
Well, did he give you, when he was pitching his idea, did he give you a sort of some sort of sense of why he was? Was it like a specific song that drove him, or what did he give you a reason? Sort of like a history of why he would want to do this. What was possessing him to want to tell your story?
Well, maybe I think it's probably in two parts. One thing is that in his early life, when he was, you know, becoming a musician, learning his trade, so to speak, he was very influenced by the Zombies. He has a genuine interest in the Zombies, and we played a part in him becoming a professional musician. And I think the second thing is that he thought there was a story to tell. This is not a typical journey through a music career, in that the band finished before our biggest hit record. We finished in 1967, and I think it was about 68 or 69. Time of the Season was a hit, and of course there was no band. And suddenly there were imposter bands, and a million things started happening. And meanwhile, Rod Argent started Argent, and I started a solo career. And there's these other stories to touch on as well. Paul Atkinson was an extremely Paul Atkinson was the lead guitarist in the Zombies. He was an extremely successful record executive. Sadly, he died in, I think it was 2004. But he'd worked with all the greats, and you hear nothing but positive reactions if you ever mention Paul Atkinson in the music business. Chris White went on to write some really big songs, and Hugh Grundy also worked in the record industry. So the story didn't end in 1967. It certainly didn't.
When you guys were playing back in the 60s, there wasn't, I don't think there's a lot of archival footage, but there is some in the film. It doesn't look, can you recall where some of that footage came from?
I can, one or two things, but I would just like to say that one of the things we were worried about when we spoke to Robert was that we didn't believe there was a lot of film. of the Zombies from the 60s. It just, people just didn't make films of bands like they do now. Some of the clips, I think one, there was a clip there of us playing at Chris White's 21st birthday party. That's before we ever made a record. I had no idea that that existed. There was a clip of us singing Going to a Go-Go live in a French TV studio, which was hysterical because it was very chaotic. Hopefully it doesn't look too chaotic in the film. And also we did the first show of Hullabaloo, and Jack Jones introduced us. And so that was a big show that we did. It was just inside 1965. We'd been over for the Murray the K Christmas show in 1964. And after that, we went on to do the Hullabaloo show with the New Christy Minstrels and Jack Jones. And there was a very glamorous girl singer and dancer, but I can't remember her name offhand. So it was great fun. Remember, we were very, very young and traveling around the world, playing the music we love with our pals. It was really great fun. And I think a lot of that comes over in the documentary that, you know, we were young guys having a wonderful time.
Well, over the years, you guys obviously have been interviewed many times. And so you're going to, certain stories come back up over and over again. But while you were working with Schwarzman, was there sort of like in the collective memory, like all of a sudden somebody recalled something and everyone else is like, oh my gosh, I completely forgot about that. Did him working with you guys bring up, remind you of any events that you had forgotten otherwise?
Well, I'll tell you, if you get the four surviving zombies together and ask all four of them one question, you'll get four very different answers. And everyone, I don't know if all bands are the same, but everyone remembers things differently. I've sat there with my mouth gaping wide open, some of the answers that come up if we're doing interviews together. I'm absolutely sure it didn't happen the way whoever it is telling the story. So that's quite intriguing, actually, how people remember things differently. I mean, that's life, isn't it? That's what happens.
Right. Okay, so the film features interviews with yourself, and we mentioned Rod Argent, the keyboard player, Chris White, the bass player, Hugh Grundy, the drummer. And as you said, your guitarist, Paul Atkinson, he passed away back in 2004. And the film, he's represented somewhat by his daughter. Can you remind me, what is her name?
Oh, I should know, shouldn't I? Of course I should.
Well, if you can't, that's okay. But no, I couldn't.
Sorry, I can't remember. But she's now working in the music business. She works for a really big agency, getting live work for bands. I'm really.
That's what I thought, that she was working in the industry. And all right, so related to this, having the daughter there, so the Zombies broke up 68-ish. You guys remained friends, and we mentioned yourself working with Rod and Chris, and Paul going on to do stuff in the music industry. Hugh Grundy also does stuff in the music industry. So you keep in touch with each other. Does that sense of family, did that transfer over to your respective children? I mean, do your kids know each other at all?
Oh, they do, actually. I think I'm not particularly involved in that sort of correspondence, but they do talk to one another. Yeah. It's interesting, really cool. Isn't it?
It's
really interesting.
A zombie, these zombie families all, scattered.
That is what it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And all the children are very interested in the zombies as well. I mean, I know, for instance, the shows that we're doing in London, my daughter's going to come, or my wife's going to come, and I'm sure all the other guys' families will be there.
Oh, right. Well, so what do you just go, now you're talking about, say again, now your daughter, your family's coming, and it's a show or it's a screening?
What we're doing in London is they'll show the documentary, and then the four of us will share the stage with Robert Schwarzman, and we'll do a Q&A with the audience, just asking us whatever, questions about the documentary and questions about the band.
So you will be sitting there with your mouth hanging open thinking, I can't believe this guy is making up the story, because that's not how it happened.
Yes, probably. Well, I'll try and keep my mouth closed. It's a bit of a giveaway, isn't it? And then on the first night that we're doing, which is next Tuesday, Tim Rice is going to come along and help with the questions, because he comes from Hatfield, where I come from, and he actually went to the same school as Rod, Paul, and Hugh. They went to a different school to me, but you know, he comes from our home area. So he's kindly agreed to come along and ask some questions and help with the questions from the audience.
Oh, great. And when is that screening, the one there in London?
It's on the 24th of June. It's in Finsbury Park. It's next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday. And that is your birthday on Tuesday?
It is, yes. Well spotted, that man. I'll spend my birthday going up to London, which is a bit like trying to get into New York. You know, it's not the easiest of journeys. So I'll be getting into London and watching the documentary and taking some questions. It's fine. I always say to my family, if we're going to celebrate my birthday, can we keep it really, really intimate and small? wasn't quite what I had planned, but it'll be fun. It'll be fun.
Well, happy pre-birthday.
Thank you so much, my friend.
All right. So the documentary had its premiere back in 2023 at South by Southwest.
Yep.
And my understanding is that for the theatrical release, it's been edited down from its original runtime.
Yeah.
What did it take out? What am I missing?
It's funny because I think the edits work really well, because when I've seen the, you know, the edited version as it is now, it runs an hour and a half. But I don't miss anything that was taken out. But they took out 15 minutes. It's a lot of film that they took out. But I think in a way, it runs a lot better now. It makes a lot more sense. So I think it was right what they did.
Is this going to be ever available on a DVD or, you know, something like that, like a Blu-ray or some kind of streaming service? Is that?
Well, that certainly is the plan. I mean, Robert Schwartzman can explain this a lot better, but he was always very keen that it should show in what we would call cinemas or theatres first. And so that's what's happening, because it is playing across America and it's playing in theatres in the UK as well. I think then gradually there's a sort of a path that they've planned. I think that it may be that you can buy it or hire it afterwards. You know, details have to yet be arranged. I don't know the details of that. And eventually, hopefully, it will be on a streaming platform. But there seems to be, and I must admit, I'm not particularly well acquainted with how the film industry works, but there seems to be a progression that they like to do. And the first thing is to try and get it into movie theatres. And I don't think it's not easy to get a music documentary into movie theatres. But they've succeeded with this one, which, you know, is really exciting.
So the upcoming reissue of Odyssey and Oracle is in mono. It's on vinyl. Can you explain why the Zombies wanted to get a mono version of the album reissued?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's partly us and partly the record company, really. But all of these records, the whole of our catalogue from 64 to 67, were originally recorded in mono. So you'll be hearing the recordings how we recorded them. The last album, Odyssey and Oracle, it's funny, stereo was just becoming popular and we recorded the whole thing in mono. And at the end of the sessions, CBS / Sony said, well, that's fine, but we want it in stereo. And so there was an effort to approximate stereo, but it was never recorded in stereo. So I think everyone's hoping that if we go back to mono, which is the way it was recorded, people will experience the albums in a different way, and hopefully a superior way.
Well, in the movie you talk about recording the album and the constraints that you guys were under financially and time wise. Can you share that story about you're there at Abbey Road, the studio and you're gathered around a piano, and then these workers come in and they sort of make off with the piano. What can you tell us that story?
Absolutely. I mean, Abbey Road at the time was probably one of the most prestigious studios in the world. And it's quite interesting that it was still run a bit like a military operation, in that the sessions ran very strictly. I mean, actually, the Beatles changed all this, but the sessions ran from 10 to 1, and you had to stop. And then from 2 to 5, then you had to stop. And from 7 to 10. And especially in the studio we were in, Studio 3, it backed onto a block of flats, and it wasn't soundproof particularly well. So it would be very strictly enforced that you stopped at 10 o'clock. And on top of that, they had... the engineers were all wore collars and ties. The technical staff wore long white coats. And the guys that just sort of, moved equipment around had these long brown coats. So we were finishing a track in Studio 3 at lunchtime, and it was called Changes. It's the first track on side 2 on Odyssey and Oracle. And it's the only track that the whole band was singing vocal harmonies. So we were around a microphone, right next to the piano, so we could get our notes for the harmonies, and the red lights on, we're recording, and we might have been vaguely aware it was coming up to 1 o'clock, and it hit 1 o'clock when we're actually singing, and these two guys in long brown coats come in and just start taking the piano away while we're singing, which I thought was amazing. To our credit, I would just say we kept singing. And I'd like to think that that's the take we use. I'd like to think that you can hear the piano being moved, but I can't say with any confidence that that is the case. But it's just, it's an unwritten law that you don't go into a studio when the red light's on, but these guys, they didn't care. They wanted that piano and they were going to get it.
So on the album, Rod Argent is playing a Mellotron. And my understanding is that was John Lennon had left it there in the studio.
Absolutely. They just finished Sergeant Pepper like a day or 2 days before we went in. And although usually they recorded in Studio 2, they had used Studio 3. So the Mellotron was in the corner and Rod, John Lennon wasn't there. So he just asked the engineers, would they mind if he used it? And if you listen to Odyssey and Oracle, there's Mellotron all over the place. It would have been a different album if that Mellotron hadn't left behind. And on a personal note, I was a huge Beatles fan. Well, we all were in the Zombies. And when we walked into the studio, there were all percussion instruments lying around on the floor. And it was a comforting thought to think that I was picking up a tambourine or maracas or whatever that had last been used by the Beatles in their recording. It was a sort of an interesting feeling, really. But, in my own way, I sort of feel I was close to greatness there when I was picking up the tambourine and maracas that the Beatles have used. That's my main connection with the Beatles, I'm afraid.
Well, I read that the guy, the keyboard player for the Moody Blues, Mike Pinder, if I'm saying his name right, if I was wondering, is Pinder or Pinder, but I'm going to say Mike Pinder. So the Moody Blues, my understanding is he had told Lennon and McCartney that they should get a Mellotron, right? And so they did that, and John Lennon had his in the studio. And then I came across this quote from George Martin, and he described the Mellotron as if a Neanderthal piano had impregnated a primitive electronic keyboard.
Yes.
And despite Sir George's naysaying, I mean, you guys really dug it, or you want to have it all over the album.
I know. I think it's got a very distinctive and, for me, very pleasant sound. Quite unique. It's quite unique. And I really liked it. I'd be up for using it now. Obviously, it's a bit old-fashioned now, but I would be very happy to use it in a recording session now. I thought it was wonderful.
So Rod, he wrote the band's several big hits, She's Not There, Tell Her No, Time of the Season, that's part of Odyssey and Oracle. And for every one of his A-sides, it seems like almost always there was a Chris White song on the B-side. And after the band broke up, Rod and Chris, they continued to work with you as writers, which you're pursuing your solo career. Out of the 12 songs on Odyssey and Oracle, Chris wrote 7, Rod wrote 5. Can you tell us anything about their relationship as the band's principal songwriters?
Well, I think they were always very close friends, and I think they inspired one another, really. And they never wrote together, but after Odyssey and Oracle, they did write all the songs under a credit of both names. I think they inspired one another, encouraged one another. It was a really healthy relationship, actually. I don't think there was ever any competition or ill feeling if one person got an A side and the other person didn't. It was, they just wanted to write really good songs and record them to the best of their ability. And that's pretty similar to the rest of the band, really.
Do you think Chris has received proper recognition for his contributions? I mean, his songs?
Well, I certainly hope so. As you rightly say, on Odyssey and Oracle, he wrote, you know, I only realized this comparatively recently, but he wrote more songs than Rod. And every song on Odyssey and Oracle, the songs that they both wrote, they're all classic songs in their own way. They're fabulous songs. I'd like to think that Chris has had the recognition he deserves. And if he hasn't, perhaps we can start a movement now and just explain to people that Chris White was a really fabulous, and is a really fabulous songwriter.
Well, one of my favorite ones on the album that he wrote, This Will Be Our Year.
Yes.
And for me, one of the things I love about it is that I quote it every year. You know, this will be our year. Took a long time to come. I think it would have made a great pairing with a pair of Cell 44 to have, you know, the prison thing on the A side, and then it's as though... you know, she's been released from prison on the B side. But do you have any on, I mean, it's unfair to ask you if you have a favorite, but out of these, that batch of songs, out of Odyssey and Oracle, is there one melody that you kind of find yourself attracted to that just kind of pops in your head more often than the others?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. At the time, Time of the Season wasn't one of my favorite tracks from Odyssey and Oracle. I'm not saying it's not a good song, but it wasn't one of my favorite tracks. So that tells you why I'll never be an A&R man in a record company, because that track sold over 2 million copies. My favorite track at the time, and possibly I would say the song I thought was most commercial, was Care of Cell 44. I just think it's such a fabulous storyline in the lyric. You know, a chap writing to his girlfriend who's in prison, and she's going to be released soon, and it's just a very exciting time for them. And I think it's fabulous, and you know, the sort of Beach Boy-esque harmonies, I just think makes it incredibly commercial. The only thing I would say is that Care of Cell 44 doesn't appear in the song. I think a bit more time might have been given to choosing the title of the song. That's the only thing I would say. Carousel 44, at the time, I really loved. A Rose for Emily, I loved. Actually, Hung Up on a Dream, I think it's a wonderful song. And I've been playing some solo dates recently, and I've been playing Hung Up on a Dream, but acoustically, just piano and voice. And it works incredibly well. This Will Be Our Year, I think, is a fabulous song. So there are a few of my favorites anyway.
Emil, I'm looking back through the track listing for it as well. I guess one is, speaking of Chris, now is he singing on Butcher's Tale?
He is, yes. It's a funny thing, really, because they did play that to me with a view to me singing it. And I just said, are you sure this song is right for this album? I was thinking about, actually, on the album, this song follows Butcher's Tale, Friends of Mine, which is a very poppy tune.
Right.
You know, it's unusual in that we're just chanting the names of people we know. There's no rhyme there. It's that there are people that we knew at the time. But I was just saying, are you sure it's going to fit in this album? And almost... as I said it, they said, well, look, don't worry, we'll get Chris to sing it. So I didn't even get a chance to really discuss it. But I think Chris did a wonderful job on it. It's a very, Butcher's Tale, a very unusual song. And he gives a very emotional interpretation of it. And when we were touring Odyssey and Oracle with the original players, so Rod, myself, Chris White and Hugh Grundy, he would bring the house down when he sang Butcher's Tale. It is just a very emotional song, and he gives an incredibly emotional performance.
There are a couple of singles that came out, I think, after the album's release, like Imagine the Swan, And I can't think of the other one offhand. Were those recorded during those sessions or?
No, it all got a little bit fragmented afterwards because the band had finished.
Yeah.
And whatever it was, a year and a half later, Time of the Season was a big hit. And of course, there was a mad scramble to get some tracks together, an album or something. And really, Imagine the Swan is Argent. It's not the Zombies. And Argent did help out. It's very kind of them. They helped out with finishing not all of the tracks that came to light after that, but some of them. They helped with filling that out because the guys were all over the place geographically, and it wasn't easy to get us back together again. But on some of the songs that came out after Time of the Season, it is the Zombies, and often we would be filling out demos that we'd recorded years before, and they'd never been used, and so we turned them into masters.
You and you mentioned earlier that you and Rod had reformed the Zombies. And what year was that? The early 2000s, or was it?
I think it was 1999. It wasn't our intention to reform the Zombies. It all started off with I had a keyboard player that kept going. Every time anybody asked him to play a concert of his own songs, he couldn't resist it, and so he would go off and play wherever it was. It could be the smallest most intimate concert in the world. There might be six people there, but if he was playing his songs, he couldn't resist it. And I turned up at a few concerts without a keyboard player. The last time was in London, and it was quite a prestigious gig. And he'd gone off somewhere to play his songs. And I managed to get hold of a keyboard player who arrived about a quarter of an hour before the show. He didn't know me. He didn't know any of my songs. He didn't know what we were going to play that night. And I can't tell you how challenging that is to go on stage with someone who just doesn't know the set. And I thought I was going to have a heart attack if I went on like that. So I phoned Rod and I said, look, I've got six more shows on this tour. I wondered if you'd come out and, you know, help me out with these six dates. And he said, well, I'd love to help you out on the six dates, but that's it. I don't want to go back on the road, but I'll do the six dates with you. But he enjoyed it so much that those six dates turned into 24, 25 years. So it was a chance thing. It was never our intention to reform the Zombies. Once we got back together again, it was a wonderful surprise, but it was a surprise that there was a worldwide interest in the Zombies repertoire. And gradually we started playing more and more Zombie tunes. When we first started, we weren't playing. I think we played She's Not There in Time of the Season, and that was probably it, because we both had solo careers and we were playing other songs. But we realized that there was a huge interest in the Zombies, and bit by bit we added Zombie tunes. And after 6 or 7 years, we thought, you know, we're playing a Zombie show, so maybe we should call it the Zombies. It took a long time.
Well, I should point out to our listeners that you guys were part of Little Steven's Underground Garage or Go-Go Tours.
Yes.
Back towards the end of 2005, there was a series of these tours, and they were big tour bus tours, and played all around the country. And my band, the Woggles, played on the Zombies' leg, and that was one of the highlights of our career, was getting a chance to hang out with you guys, play with you guys, and see you every night.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, we were genuinely thrilled to watch the Woggles as well. If you haven't seen the Woggles play, you must go, because I've never seen a stage act like it. And I'm always pleasantly surprised when I meet or speak to Manfred, because he throws himself around so much in the stage act. I'm always worried he's going to end up injured or you know, prematurely retired, perhaps. And so it's great to hear that, you know, everything's still, the band's still working. And
still working, still working.
Everything in Manfred is still working as well after the, you know, as I say, the way he throws himself about. Unbelievable.
Well, thank you, Colin. Well, so serious. Here's a serious question that related to you and Rod getting back together. So last year, I believe it was in July, he had a stroke, and it was announced he had retired from touring. How is Rod doing?
He's doing really well. He is doing really well. And he's coming to the shows next week. He's going to come to the Q&As. So I think, you know, he needed a period of rest after that stroke, of course. And now he's recuperated and he's pretty much back to his old self now. But he has decided he's not going to tour anymore. It is, you know, it's, I mean, you know more than anyone that it is quite tough touring. Even just the traveling takes it out of you, let alone the actual performance. And he's decided, you know, he was 80 a few days ago. He's 10 days older than me. He's decided that at 80, it's time for him to retire now. But of course, I think he was thinking about it anyway. But obviously, it came about a little bit sooner than he was expecting, as he had this stroke in the summer.
Does that mean, so touring is one thing, doing a show is different? Is there a possibility in the future that you think you guys might still get together? Or when the reissue actually comes out, could there be another performance of Odyssey and Oracle?
I don't know. It very much depends on Roy. I no way want to pressure him. If he feels that he'd like to do it, that's fantastic. I know he wants to keep writing and he wants to keep recording. He's got a lovely recording studio in his house. But I'm not sure about the playing live. He certainly won't tour. Whether he would ever play live again, I'm leaving it very much up to him, obviously, because the most important thing is his health, you know, and he needs to protect himself. But if he wanted to play live again, and he wanted me to be involved, of course I'd jump at it.
Are you going to continue doing shows?
I am, yes, for my sins. I've played quite a few solo shows over the last few months, mostly in the UK and Europe, actually. I did do a few shows in America, but mostly in the UK and Europe. And I actually toured, my first solo album is called 1 Year, and it features a lot of string quartet arrangements, wonderful arrangements by an arranger called Chris Gunning. And it does make touring that album a bit difficult because you have to have a rock band and you have to have a string quartet as well. But we did it. We did 4 or 5 shows with a wonderful string quartet called the Q Strings. And it was wonderful. We've also recorded it as well and videoed it. Is that what they call it? Filmed it.
Yes, I believe so.
Yes. I'm not au fait with all these modern bits and pieces. But yes, they filmed it and recorded it. And that will be available. I don't have a timescale for it, but it will be available over the next few months. It's finished. I mean, it's ready to go. So that was really good fun. I'm going to play one of these musical themed cruises called On the Blue, which originally featured the Moody Blues, but as they don't play anymore, Justin Hayward hosts the cruise, and it features people like myself and Alan Parsons and Al Stewart. It's a really great artist, but it's really good for me because I know these people, so it gives me a chance to catch up with them.
So one more thing before as I wrap up here, you also spoke touched on the song Hung Up on a Dream, which is a title to the documentary. I wanted to ask you specifically about it. You know, it's one of Rod's songs, and in it, you know, the protagonist is recounting this dream, and the singer says, you know, he meets men with flowers in their hair, and they spoke with soft, persuading words about a living creed of gentle love. I was just wondering, so how kind of hip were the zombies to like the whole flower power counterculture movement going on in the 60s? Were you related to that at all? I mean, you saw it going on, or was there any connection to that when you would do shows? Or
I don't think so. I mean, we were aware of it as anyone would be, but I think we followed it more sort of in the news and in cinema and things like that. I think it was a lot more prevalent in like the West Coast of America than it was here. I mean, it was going on here, but I don't think the zombies were particularly personally involved in that. But we were very keen onlookers, and obviously Rod absorbed quite a lot of what was going on. I think one of the reasons, he never seemed to really want to play Hung Up on a Dream, because I did suggest it to him, and you just mentioned a line there, men with flowers in their hair, which I think he felt appropriate at the time. But I think he felt a little bit shy about that line in later life. Yeah. But I think, you know, you're talking about another time, and I think it really works really well. I think the lyric for that song is magical. I think it's brilliant.
Well, I do too. And so when you guys are back together to do that Oracle and Odyssey performance, you should bring it up again and say, Rod, it's the title to the movie.
I know.
We got to play it.
I don't want him to play it now because I'm playing it with my solo band.
So
want him to steal our thunder.
Right.
No, I mean, if we ever do play again, I probably will suggest it to him and we'll see what happens. Because I think when he didn't know we were playing that song, it was on another on the Blue Cruise a couple of years ago. And he didn't know that we were going to play that. And he told me afterwards, he was firstly shocked and surprised, but he absolutely loved it. So I think I'd get a better response from you now if I was to suggest that we, the Zombies, play that.
Colin, I guess I have to wrap things up. I want to thank you so, so very, very much for making this such an extra special Coolest Conversations.
Thank you so much, Manfred. It's great talking to you.
Right now, though, we got to give a listen to Hung Up on a Dream off the new remastered mono version of Odyssey and Oracle in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That was some of Hung Up on a Dream from the Zombies here in Little Steven's Underground Garage off their soon-to-be-reissued seminal album Odyssey and Oracle. The song also serves as a title to their documentary. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to lead singer Colin Blunstone for speaking with me today. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza and Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. Singer-songwriter Ryan Hamilton, he's got a new single out now on Wicked Cool Records. It's titled Godspeed, and we'll find out all about it next time around on your Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.